from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
Hello, everyone. You won't hear your names being called. It's noisy already. Please talk soft, but keep talking.
So begins the new documentary, The Waiting Room, which captures a day in the life of the ER at Oakland's Highland Hospital. A lot of people go through Highland's ER every day, but this film isn't about numbers. It's about parents and sick kids, people with kidney disease and cancer, people who have insurance and people who don't. It's about the people who need care and the people who provide it. It's an intimate, personal, and powerful world. We'll meet the director of The Waiting Room and listen to excerpts from the film next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. They keep coming, 24/7, every day, every week, year in and year out. It might be a girl with strep throat or a young man with cancer. It might be someone with gunshot wounds, a bad back, a bad kidney, or just bad luck. They're people who need care, and they come to the ER at Oakland's Highland Hospital. And that one small, painful, intimate space is the setting for a new, powerful film called The Waiting Room. Filmed over a period of months, it captures a composite day in the life of Highland's ER and waiting room, a place of striking contrasts, of great need, but also great caring. The Waiting Room opens today at the Sundance Kabuki in San Francisco, the Grand Lake in Oakland, and Camera 3 in San Jose. The director of The Waiting Room is Peter Nix, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Morning, Dave.
Pleasure to have you here. One of my first reactions, and I had many, to this terrific and powerful film of yours, is that it somehow manages to convey everything that's wrong and everything's right with healthcare.
Well, you know, that's right, and that's really what we were trying to get at with the film. I mean, the first time I saw The Waiting Room, I felt that it was such a reflection of our community that is Oakland.
When you first, the actual waiting room, as opposed
physically,
to the film, when you were first there.
When
yeah.
I first, you know, walked into that waiting room. And I knew about the hospital before because my wife, I came out of graduate school. I went to the graduate school of journalism at Berkeley, and I got my documentary film degree there. And my wife was coming out of, got her master's in speech pathology at the same time, and her first job was at Highland. And she would tell me, she would bring home these stories of her patients that were really quite remarkable. And it gave me a really intimate view of, you know, who the uninsured were beyond, you know, the headlines and the statistics. And so my antenna immediately went up as a storyteller that, wow, this would be a great film. And when it came time to make the film and I actually, you know, walked into the waiting room for the first time and sort of really experienced it in that visceral way, I was struck by the humanity of the place, you know, and how it was a reflection, how it really felt like a reflection of our community at this moment in time, you know, when we're dealing with sort of multiple crises in our nation, not just healthcare, but the economy. And I felt that it was a microcosm and also a metaphor in a lot of ways. And so that's really what sort of got me going.
In an interesting way, it's sort of what doesn't get talked about in this ongoing and perennial and controversial and conflicted debate we have about healthcare in this country. What's kind of missing is that personal part of it. I mean, it's life at its most personal, both for the people who come in need of care, but also for the people who provide it.
Well, you know, what happened was I'd wanted to make this film for a long time, but you know, didn't know how to approach the hospital, and well before healthcare became such a politically divisive issue. And my wife and I, you know, had our first child, moved to New York City, and you know, came back because they offered her a job at the hospital, and we decided we want to settle in the Bay Area. And one of the first days back at the hospital, she came home and said, "They're making a documentary about Highland." And I said, "Oh man, missed my chance." And it turned out it was Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, and I know Jeffrey because he edited my first documentary. And so I approached them, and they needed a producer, and I came on board. And through a variety of unfortunate events, the project stalled. They financing for another film came through, and they had to go make that film. But I couldn't get it out of my head. And so I restarted the film. I approached everybody and said, I'd like to take over the project. I'll raise the money. And Bill Hirsch and Scott Vergis were a couple of local attorneys who had got the film going, knew somebody at the hospital, got the access. And I decided that I wanted to create not just a film, but an interactive storytelling project. So I went, I workshopped the project through the Bay Area Video Coalition with the premise that, you know, people were sitting in the waiting room, not just at Highland, but all over the country at a moment when we were debating the healthcare crisis and their voices were not being represented in the conversation. And so we simply, you know, went in and asked, what are you waiting for, was our question. And the responses that we got were really quite remarkable in these moments that were poignant and powerful and very telling without saying, you know, what do you think about Obamacare or what do you think about this hospital? People just wanted to share a little piece of who they were, and they wanted a little bit of dignity in that moment, which is really quite painful and disconnecting when you're stuck in a waiting room. And that set the tone for the film.
Let's listen to a first excerpt from the film. This is, in a way, the kind of scene that you imagine often happens in the ER. It's a young dad who brings in his girl who's quite ill. And he's greeted by one of the more compelling characters of the film, the nurse. And let's just listen to this exchange.
Hi, baby.
She can't speak. Her tongue is
swollen.
We don't know what's wrong. It's some kind of infection because I can smell her breath.
So,
it's real bad.
Is it back way back here?
Mm-hmm. So do they don't have to do any tonsil work or anything?
I don't know what they have to do.
I'm so nervous. I don't know what to do.
You're Papa, you be nervous. It's okay.
I'm so nervous.
But that's what daddies do. They're nervous because they take care of their loved ones.
I know. I just wanted her to get seen as soon as possible.
They will. There always is some way.
This is the first time I've gone almost a year without a job. I'm used to having those benefits, you know, that's how important a job is, to be able to have somebody look at her as soon as possible. And it just seems like a letdown. You depend on somebody to help you out when you're not having the means to do it yourself the right way, you know? It's just, it's okay, I'm glad that there's a way to provide to help out, but I wish it would have been another way for me to do this.
That heart rate is really high.
Yeah, she's just pounding like we did.
Because she's full of fever, I can feel it. You got a whole radio station, 103.4. See, they got a radio station in there. Girl, you are really hot.
I love that nurse. She's one of the great characters of the film.
She's just remarkable. You know, and early on in the process, you know, of, you know, casting the film and trying to find caregivers to represent the hospital, she immediately stood out to me as not only somebody who I would want in my film, you know, as a filmmaker, but also the type of caregiver that I would want, like if I ever went into a hospital, if I'm sick, that's the type of person I want seeing me, somebody who looks me in the eye and asks me how I'm doing and who I feel like genuinely cares. And I think a lot of times in our healthcare, people just don't have enough time to really get to that level. And she did it very quickly, elicited story from people. And it was so profound. And we really wanted to capture that.
She has this extraordinary ability that you see throughout the film to both get right at, as you're saying, as you just said, Peter, that the heart of what the problem is, but also sort of no nonsense. And, you know, there's this one scene where there's someone cursing and she just puts him in his place like that.
That's right. She can talk to anybody from, you know, from a gangster down to a 7-year-old with a strep throat. And it's a cultural competency that I think is incredibly important and often overlooked in healthcare. And, you know, she's from the community. You know, she was born at Highland. She knows a lot of people who are coming, you know, up to her triage station. They're her neighbors, their friends, her relatives. And so there's a deep connection. And that's also that connection. Is also one that community has with the hospital and has had for generations and is very similar to a lot of public hospitals all over the country. We wanted to try to capture that a little bit.
And that scene plays out throughout the course of the film, what happens with that little girl and also the sort of other drama that plays out, which is the relationship between an estranged couple that sort of unites again over what's going to happen to their little girl. That's part of what plays out in the waiting room as well. It's not just it's health in the biggest sense of the word, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and I think one of the themes in the film is are what is the meaning of not just individual relationships, but community, and that sometimes, for a variety of reasons, we're brought together, sometimes against our will, sometimes because of circumstance, but that the idea that we're all kind of bound together, we're all vulnerable to illness, we're vulnerable to the economy, we could lose our job. You know, there are people in the hospital who had just lost their job who found themselves in a public hospital for the first time. And that coming together, it brings people together in surprising ways. And so here you had a couple that's been separated, but they're there united because of their daughter. And I think you feel in his frustration, his sense of he's trying to get his dignity, he's trying to, you know, be strong for his daughter, but he's also vulnerable and he's also a bit powerless. And so we wanted to try to sort of articulate through the film what that meant and what that felt like on an average day.
And part of what that nurse conveys to him is it's going to be okay to him, not just to the little girl. She says later in that scene, it's going to be okay, Big Papa. It's like it's okay. You may not have a job, but you're doing what you need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think she really empowers the individual who comes in, someone who's coming in, you know, without health insurance, not knowing how long they're going to wait, not having a lot of questions. It's a very, for some people, terrifying time. And she somehow puts people at ease. She gives people that little bit of strength that helps them get through the day. And we felt that that was an important idea because I think we're all looking for a better healthcare system. We're looking, and she symbolizes, you know what that means.
Let's listen to another clip, and to help set this up, Peter, maybe you can describe a little of this particular case. This is a young man who's had a stroke, and he's visited by one of the ER docs. We're going to hear in a moment him make a phone call about him, about sort of what to do next. But part of what you take us through is that it's not just the strep throats or the person who just twisted an ankle. There are people who come in with these very serious problems but don't necessarily have anywhere else to go.
And this is one of the issues with, you know, the healthcare system that we wanted to try to show in a way that didn't necessarily, point any fingers. But the reality is that the way people are sort of shuffled around because you don't have insurance, you may start at one hospital and then have to move to another hospital. And when you get to that other hospital, they're trying to figure out where did you come from, what's your history. And a lot of times in this man's case, he doesn't have a primary care doctor. He has no, you know, continuity of care, really. He's never been to a hospital. And so here they are trying to figure out what to do with him next. And oftentimes, there's no easy solution.
So let's listen. This is Dr. White, I believe. He's making a phone call after seeing this stroke patient and trying to figure out how he can get this person further care.
The problem is there's no general medicine appointments until next March. So I can't let this guy slip through the cracks until next March. I mean, this is obviously a problem in our system, but someone needs to take responsibility for him. I mean, he had a stroke a couple days ago, and he's 44. He's got the rest of his life. So, any suggestions? I know you know that internal medicine side of the world better than I do, as far as appointments and stuff. If there's anything you can think of, would you be willing to take him? That's fine. That's fine. Oh, my God, you're the best. Unfortunately, we see a lot of patients coming in with very treatable conditions who don't have access to a regular doctor. I know that I can make someone better in the short term, but the ER is not the place to manage someone's overall health. It's going to require a heck of a lot more follow-up that I can't provide. So no medical appointments for the next couple months, so I just played basically a guilt trip on the neurology team saying someone has to take care of him, so she's going to take him in her private clinic in a month. Mm-hmm. That's the best we can do. We can take what we can get.
So we see that these ER docs not only are providing emergency care, they're having to sort of help people get to the next phase of the system because it isn't there for them.
And that was one of the fascinating things that I know, that one of the first surprises was that tension between this ER basically having to provide primary care to an entire community and also having to handle the traumas that come in, which suck up a tremendous amount of resources, not just money, but time and people. Like when a gunshot wound victim comes in, all the doctors, nurses, volunteers, flood the trauma bay. And then the person sitting in that waiting room with a fever or with an upset stomach or a pain in their knee, their wait is extended hours. And so that tension between this hospital ER providing primary care and dealing with true emergencies was fascinating. We wanted to try to show what that meant and how it worked.
And you can sense some in that particular doctor's voice and in other comments he makes in the film, his frustration that there isn't a better way for these people to get care, that we don't have that figured out in this country. And this brings me to a question I wanted to ask you, Peter, about your sort of filmic approach, because this is a film done without narration. It's without even subtitles telling us who these individuals are. It just plays out. It's like you're there witnessing this drama play out before your eyes. Was it hard to resist the temptation, the sort of Michael Moore impulse to sort of bring out your bat and hit people over the head and say, see, this is why we need single payer or whatever it happens to be?
We had many discussions about this. My instinct early on, when my wife first came home with these stories and my antenna first went up in wanting to make a film about this place, I just wanted to tell a story about a community trying to get by day to day. And not even really in the context of, being insured or being uninsured, just the sheer humanity of the place and the sort of profound and surprising stories. But of course, in the intervening years, healthcare has become a massive issue, incredibly divisive. And so you can't really escape that reality. You put a film out there like this, it's going to be talked about in the context of healthcare. One of our major funders, ITVS, Independent Television Service, gave us incredible independence in deciding on what approach to take. My argument to them was that I felt that by taking an apolitical approach, by simply allowing the audience in an intimate, an immersive way into the lives of these people, that actually makes a powerful statement. Because at this moment in the debate around healthcare reform, the stage is dominated by people with the megaphone,
It's an interesting, there are really two questions in a way, because one is whether or not you take a point of view, the sort of Michael Moore approach where you're advocating for a particular solution to a problem. But and you come out of a journalism background, used to work for Nightline at ABC, even within the more non-advocacy approach to journalism, there's usually the tendency to say, the old rule of, I'm going to tell them what I'm going to tell them, then I'm going to tell them, and then I'm going to tell them what I told them, that we're going to just lay this out for you and say, here, this is what the story is about. You chose not to do that. You chose to let people just take it in.
Yeah, because I felt that, what we did have was the tree shaking. That was happening. Politicians, media pundits, lobbyists, all the people who had access to the megaphone, so to speak, were the ones who were controlling the conversation. The people that were on the front lines, and not just a Highland, but in public hospitals all over the country, didn't really have a voice. We didn't really understand who they were and what their day-to-day was like. And from my point of view, we need to have a balance in storytelling that allows that kind of immersive and non apolitical storytelling to inform the discussion. And so, when we decided to take that approach, it wasn't lightly. I think there were many conversations about, should we have narration? Should we have text cards? And even to this day, people say, why didn't you tell us? But do a little, where are they now at the end of the film? And, I tell them that, the story of this hospital, it fills up every day, that waiting room, and the staff works really hard to clear it. And then the next day, the bus arrives and it happens all over again.
It's a really important point, and part of what I think it's telling that people want to know what happens to people, and that's because you've done a good job of creating these characters. You care about them. You want to know what happens to the little girl with the strep throat or whatever it happens to be. But the point is also made in the film that it just keeps coming, and you purposely, I think, leave some things unresolved. There's an angry patient who comes in needing kidney dialysis, and you can see the doctor is sort of befuddled and perplexed about what to do, and the scene just ends. probably, I guess, because that just keeps happening. There really isn't an end to that story.
It's exactly right, and it was very deliberate. And there are lots of analogies that we've heard from the doctors, whether it's, you know, Hamburger Hill or shoveling sand against the tide, that sort of describe this really frustrating feeling of working so hard to provide care, to clear that waiting room, and then just to see it happen over and over and over again, that we wanted to try to capture that in some way, while at the same time bringing you closely into the lives of these people so that you got to know them in that moment. Maybe you don't know their name, but they represent somebody that you love. They represent, you know, your uncle, your neighbor, your friend, your father.
And in that effort to clear the waiting room, because you have to find spaces for these people, there are almost sometimes these almost kind of comic moments. There's a scene where there are two doctors trying to figure out how can we get a bed for this person, because this room is filled and this room, they're all filled everywhere, and if we move A to B and B to C and so forth and so on. And then the one doctor finally says something like, oh, well, here's someone. All I have to do is an aorta scan and that room will be clear. And you sort of chuckle because it's like, you know, when you don't think of an aorta scan being something that funny or that basic, but that's what needs to happen in order to clear the room.
And we wanted to give the audience permission to laugh. And
yeah.
I mean, we didn't want to set out intentionally to try to entertain people. But the reality is that in pain, there was always humor. You know, in struggle, there's always that sort of that beautiful sort of sense of whatever it is, serendipity or comedy that exists in every situation. And we wanted to show that in the film because we saw it, you know, in the years that I spent in the hospital before we really started filming. I saw it over and over. And with CJ, the nurse there, every time I would put down the camera, she would have a one-liner. She would sing a song. We'd go, oh, I missed that. So we wanted to try to capture really what that was.
She has one of the other great sort of comeback lines when she is getting that guy who's cursing straight and saying, you were raised better than that. Don't do that anymore. And then at the end she says, are you a Scorpio?
That's right.
We're talking with Peter Nix, the documentary filmmaker. His new film is called The Waiting Room. It opens today at the Sundance Kabuki in San Francisco, the Grand Lake in Oakland, and Camera 3 in San Jose. We're coming up on a break, and I want to ask people to call in and describe their own experiences in the waiting room of a hospital ER. What has that experience been like for you? Or if you're an ER physician or nurse or work in that circumstance, what has that experience been like for you? Want to hear more of those stories as we continue to focus in on this story, the story of the waiting room. Our number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. The film will be opening soon, today and elsewhere. What sort of response are you getting to this story? And in your effort to have this be something that is talked about, not just the film itself, but to have this sort of sense of conversation that we hope will happen in the second half of this program, but that you're doing online as well.
Well, you know, ironically, because we decided to take a somewhat apolitical approach to the film, it's made it a little more difficult to get people's attention, you know, in terms of that sort of core, you know, when you sort of throw red meat out to people, if it's a polemic film, for instance, it's a little bit easier to sort of have people like grab it and use it. But our idea is just to get it out in communities, theaters, you know, church basements, you know, medical schools all over the country.
We'll talk more with Peter Nix about why this film is worth seeing. You can see a trailer of it, by the way, on our website at kqed.org/forum. Back with more about The Waiting Room and Peter Nix. Join us at 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Peter Nix. He's the director of the new documentary, The Waiting Room, which opens today in San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose. You can watch a trailer of the film on our website at kqed.org/forum. I'd like to hear your own experiences within the emergency room and the waiting room, whether as a patient or as someone who might work in the waiting room. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786 for your stories about being in the ER. Let's hear first from Alana in San Francisco. Alana, go ahead.
Hi. I recently was at UCSF Medical Center in the waiting room at the emergency room and had a similar experience to what your guest mentioned where we was not or in this movie. We were waiting and waiting and waiting, and we had sort of the resident was helping us, and I think there were the two opposite extremes where the doctor that was in charge sort of wasn't hearing what we were saying, and the resident was trying really hard to patch together the care that we needed, and you could see the struggle going on between the two of them, sort of the power struggle, as well as the patient. I wasn't the patient. I was helping my father-in-law, trying to sort of advocate for him, and while understanding that, you know, that the emergency room, they have to do what they have to do in that moment, while sort of neglecting to take into picture his entire healthcare situation, where he did not have a good prognosis, and what we wanted to get done sort of might have helped him in the short term, but they just kind of couldn't do it for us. So
thank
you. It was an interesting situation. So
thank you, Alana. It brings up, Peter Nix, this interesting task that happens in the waiting room. As Alana describes, there's a lot of information that people have to process very quickly, and a real limitation to what they can actually do. You see that frustration play out of people who come in wanting something that the ER can't necessarily deliver.
Yeah, and what we were trying not to do with the film was take sides to necessarily say, oh, you know, patients, you're frustrated, but you know, you don't understand. You know, here's a and on the flip side, you know, we didn't want to you know, demonize the patients, but why are you complaining? You should be grateful that you even have a place to go. What we want to do is show how it worked from both sides and give that point of view from both sides, and showing the dynamics that the staff has to, the very complex dynamics that they have to deal with. And then also on the other side, the fact that these are people who have families, a lot of times they're with a loved one, who really want information and deserve as much information as possible. But the realities of the situation often don't allow the doctors, the physicians to give what they really want to give to the patient, to do what they want to do for the patient. They just have to, they're usually doing the bare minimum to get that patient moved through, seen, so that the bed is freed up so that they can keep the flow moving.
You hear a number of times just people saying, I know you're hurting, but other people are hurting too. You'll have to wait. I mean, that the sense of waiting, and that it will, and that we're always waiting, keeps coming through.
And those decisions are made behind closed doors. There's no real transparency, so the patient can't really see what the doctors are dealing with back in the ED behind the door. So that's what we did as filmmakers, just try to pull that curtain back so you can see that the challenges that they're facing. And that's a challenge, because that frustration, that the doctors try to explain it to the patients, but it's very hard to do.
Let's hear next from Mike, who joins us from Berkeley. Mike, go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Thanks for taking the call. I real quickly, you know, I've been there numerous times, and I've had to wait up to 7-8 hours sometimes.
And you mean at Oakland, at Highland?
Yes, at Highland. And unfortunately, you know, the economic downfall put me in a situation where I had no medical. The most recent challenge that I had, well, not real recent, but I had a knee injury where it needed surgery, and they elected to go ahead and just have me on physical therapy. Well, 2 years later, after I finally got the appointment, I got canceled 2 or 3 times. They kept missing up my appointment, and I had to start over all over from the beginning. Finally had it done in April, and when I woke up from surgery, the pain I had, apparently one of the nurses that were there, she ended up ODing me, and my girlfriend slash our fiancé at the time, you know, it was just actually a horrific experience of me just having this throwing up and all these issues that occurred. And then it was just, you know, it's like two whole different worlds in the waiting room. It's like third world. But then once you get past those doors, it's like professionalism. So it's like there's two things happening. Unfortunately, I got that one nurse that kind of messed me up. But it is a process, and you guys are right. I mean, at least it's something. So
yeah.
I was blessed with that. But unfortunately, you got to deal with some of the bad to get some good.
Mike, thanks. Thanks for the call. Appreciate you joining our conversation. Let's hear next from Nicole in Oakland. Nicole, go ahead.
Hi. I had also spent many, many hours at the Highland Hospital waiting room, but it was when I was younger, and I just moved to California for love, and I had no job and no place to live, and I got very sick. And I remember, I think the previous caller maybe said it was like a third world place. It was definitely different from the Midwest, where I had been under my parents' insurance. But what I most remember, besides the hours of waiting, was the terror, the absolute terror, to think that I'm so sick and I have no money and no way to pay for this. And having had no experience with not having insurance, I was amazed when, you know, they kept asking me, do you have a job? Well, no, I'm looking. Where do you live? Well, I'm between places. And, you know, they covered everything. And I was so grateful. And I remember, it just always made me think we really need universal health coverage, because people, I think, who are maybe against it don't understand how absolutely to the bone terrifying it is to think you can't pay for something to make the pain stop or to help a loved one.
Nicole, thanks. Thanks for the call. Those are stories. I mean, those are the kinds of things you saw, Peter.
Yeah, and was it Mike described? I mean, it's exactly right. It's sort of like the promised land, you know, like those doors back to the ED where you get seen. And you know, Highland's got some of the best caregivers, you know, in this country, and it's got a high match rate, which means that, you know, because there's so much, you get such great training from the traumas to advanced disease, it attracts some of the very best medical students in the country. And I think people are surprised by the level of care. You're always going to have those bad situations, whether it's a nurse who doesn't treat you well or a doctor. I mean, I've had that with my private insurance. But what we were surprised by is, and it's almost like a little bit of a love-hate relationship people have with Highland, is that dual feeling of frustration, especially in the waiting room where you're waiting,
right,
and that gratefulness of like, wow, I'm getting good care when you get back there. And that was something that we wanted to try to capture, both sides of that.
I want to play one more clip from the film. This is one that was surprising to me, because when I think of the ER, I don't think of someone coming in with the particular situation that this young man and his partner came in with. So let's just listen to what transpires in this one short clip.
And what's wrong with you today?
I have a testicular tumor. And I need to have surgery on it as soon as possible.
Where were you diagnosed?
Over at Kaiser.
Do you have any paperwork from them?
So they did all the tests. Do you need to see it now?
I just want to know if they did. They.
We have an ultrasound, a CT scan, a chest X-ray, all the blood work. So basically, we went through all the tests, and the surgery was supposed to take place today. And they let us go through all the tests, and they canceled the surgery yesterday.
At Kaiser?
Yeah.
The Matrix Washington.
We're not members.
I don't have any coverage, and I don't have any insurance.
So why did they tell you that before they scheduled it?
Well, they were asking us all along whether we're members, but we always said no.
So here's something I didn't know happened in the emergency room, that someone would come in with testicular cancer and was about to have surgery, but then it was canceled because it turns out he wasn't part of Kaiser. I mean, that's not you wouldn't imagine that having to figure that one out would be something that happens in an ER, and it probably happens all the time.
Well, and that's what happens when you don't have insurance, is you got to figure out what do you do if you get sick, and it's not always very obvious. And in this particular case, I mean, he didn't come in with a cancer. He came in with a tumor. But what preceded that was he was just not feeling well, you know, and his girlfriend was like, you need to see a doctor. And so they started calling around and HMOs, and a lot of them wouldn't take him without insurance. And finally, Kaiser said that they would take him, and he could put it on a credit card, and so they went to Kaiser, and he did the first few appointments, and everything starts to happen very quickly, and before you know it, they realize, oh, you have a tumor, and that needs to be removed. Well, it's time for surgery, and they're like, wait, oh, you're not a member. We're not going to, you know, this is a very expensive surgery. You can't put that on a credit card. And so at that point, he had to figure out an alternative. You know, what are you going to do next? Well, you end up at Highland.
And you're one more person in the waiting room.
Right.
Yeah. Some emails and web comments coming in. Allison writes, how did the producers go about the tricky business of approaching patients in this moment of distress and worry to get permission to film and getting them to sign some sort of release form?
You know, I think the patients at Highland that are in the film that are represented in our waiting room, who are, by extension are people in communities all around this country, have not really been asked, you know, how are you doing? Who are you? What's your story? And I think that when we approached people, and we would just queue up in the line in the morning along with folks and just quickly try to introduce ourselves and explain to them what we were trying to do and the story we were trying to tell, I think people instinctively felt that this was an opportunity for them to share a little bit of who they were and to capture a little bit of that dignity that they haven't had an opportunity to present. You know, I think for a long time they've just been, you know, a headline or a statistic, the uninsured. And that young couple, the young guy with the tumor, we were at a screening in New York and somebody in the audience asked him, why did you allow these filmmakers to follow you? And, you know, what was that like? And they described it almost as a comforting presence, that it gave them some comfort just having us there in that moment. And that's not going to work for everybody, but a surprising number of people were eager to allow us into their lives for that brief moment because they have great needs. They have great needs, not just in terms of their health, but in terms of their lives. This is a community that's been struggling with economic challenges for generations. And for someone to come in and express an interest in who they were and what their story was, I think prompted a lot of people to allow us into their lives, even though they're in a moment of crisis.
Another question coming in about how you did the film. This person posted on our website. This is a complicated question, but something about Dave's introduction to the segment caught my ear when he said that it was filmed over months to capture a composite day. If that's how it's structured as a day in the life, then isn't it inherently deceptive because it would no doubt cherry pick the most poignant incidents that fit the narrative? Even doing it all in one day, there's editorial discretion, but over months, that might be amplified manyfold.
We were there. I've been hanging out in that hospital, you know, probably for 3 years before we started filming, and I witnessed many a day in the waiting room. And we actually thought about a couple of different approaches to making the film. One was, you know, getting like 20 cameras and shooting the same day over and over and over. And sort of logistically, it became cost prohibitive to do that. And then we decided that the structure of the film, after we actually started filming, we decided that, you know, we needed a way for the audience to be pulled through the film. And that the 24-hour, you know, the idea of one day in the life of this community was not just a sort of a metaphor with, you know, the clock on the wall and the waiting room, but it was also a way to sort of communicate an idea of what the hospital is dealing with day in and day out. And, you know, our job as filmmakers is to represent. Every filmmaker can manipulate, you know, story by making a choice, whether it's, you know, a camera angle or whether it's a sound bite. That goes for a New York Times news story to a Michael Moore film to a cinema verite film, and so that's just inherently part of the process. And so we took our job very seriously in terms of trying to represent what we felt was a average day. We didn't, you know, the film isn't overly dramatic and it doesn't undersell what happens in the waiting room, but it really presents what we felt was an average day at Highland.
Peter Nix, our guest. The film, again, is The Waiting Room. Opens today at the Sundance Kabuki in San Francisco. One person wanted to know why it's not opening in Oakland. It is. It's opening at the Grand Lake in Oakland and at Camera 3 in San Jose. Let's hear from more of our listeners. Janet joins us next. Janet, go ahead.
Yes, I was just in the waiting room at Highland yesterday. I come back from 7 hours flight on the West Coast, and the East Coast, and I had a muscle spasm, which was really, I was in really intense pain. And I noticed that all of the people that were there for registration were very pleasant. I noticed that they had translators for a woman who came in who spoke Spanish. A translator was right there. And also there was a young man who was in intense pain and doubled over. And as soon as the woman saw him and in the back, not the back of the line, but he was in line, she asked for a chair to bring out for him and moved him to the front of the line. I can just say that, you know, it's a distressful situation to be in emergency, but I think that Highland gives really good service. And this is not my first time there also, but I just wanted to weigh in on that.
Jana, thank you.
I mean, that, you hear that a lot from people. We were surprised when we began the digital storytelling project. We didn't ask people directly what they thought about Highland, but inevitably it would come up. And sometimes it was in the same sentence. They'd you know, express frustration with having to wait. But when it got into the relationships that they had with the caregivers there, the clerks, the nurses, the certified nurse assistants, the LVNs, a lot of those people are from that community. And so there's a connection and there's a sort of cultural competency that they have. And that goes with the translators. They're able to deal with people who speak multiple languages. I think they can handle up to 27 different languages there. Their program there is phenomenal. And people know that. And a lot of people actually choose to go to Highland for that very reason.
There are a number of people who have either posted comments or our website or emailed in about sort of their ER horror story, or someone who writes in about bringing his wife to the emergency room at San Francisco General, writhing in unimaginable pain. We waited in the room for 13 tortuous hours. I remember thinking that the waiting room is simply a cruel human filter. It keeps everyone out but the most sick. There's no comfort, just plastic chairs, an extremely loud TV, and harsh flickering lights. And several others make the same sort of point. I mean, that's part of the reality, too. I mean, your film captures great compassion, but it's also fair to say that there's no minimizing the amount of pain in the waiting room.
So here's what I'll say about you know, an editorial comment that I think the film does make, which is that the people in the waiting room are beautiful people, just like the people waiting. Sure, you're going to get your occasional caregiver who treats you like crap, and on the flip side, you're going to get your occasional patient who's just, you know, a real challenge to deal with. But these are people. These are us. They represent our communities. But the system that they're working in has all kinds of problems and flaws that prevents the type of care to be given that I think the caregivers there want to give, and that I think the patients deserve to get. You know, and that I think was really a statement that the film wanted to try to make.
And does. Nancy in Palo Alto is next.
Hi. I was at a private hospital, Stanford University ER. My mother had been taken there with a stroke, and found myself in the ER in the middle of a gang fight because of other people who were waiting that happened to have shot each other. It was a terrible situation. There were frightened people both on the caregiver side and the patient side until the police finally arrived and calmed it down. And subsequent to that, this was several years ago, the next time I went to the ER for something for myself, I found armed guards and metal detection, and it's like getting into a government building. Have you seen an increase in waiting room violence over at Highland?
I can't speak to any increase in violence at Highland. I do know that that's part and parcel of the system, is the community in which Highland is in, and a lot of public hospitals around the country. Violence is a huge problem. It's a public health issue, and you know, Highland has, you know, sheriff's deputies over there to deal with any unforeseen circumstances like the one you described has happened at Highland and has happened at public hospitals all over the country, and that's sort of that dichotomy, or you know, I don't know what you'd call it, but you know, people who are going to Highland to seek primary care because they don't have a primary care physician can find themselves caught in those kinds of circumstances, and that's just a reality. That's a reality of our safety net system. This is a hospital that's the institution of last resort for people. It's where everybody goes who can't be captured by the private system, and so, or who doesn't have insurance, who doesn't have, you know, the means, or is brought in by, you know, ambulance or whatever. So that's just a reality of the system.
Nancy, thanks for the call. I want to play one last clip because Nancy reminds me of the real factor of violence and the victims of violence that wind up in the waiting room and then in the ER. So this comes late in the film, and as you listen, imagine the emergency room scene as a group of doctors are working on a victim of a violent incident. So let's listen to this scene.
Continue CPR. We're not ready. So let's check our ultrasound and look at the cardiac activity.
Which probe do you have?
Stop CPR. Let's check cardiac activity.
Parmar, feel for pulses, please. Parmar.
Neck. Carotid pulses.
He doesn't have electrical activity.
No. No pulses.
I got nothing up here.
Let's roll him before we call it. Make sure there's nothing back.
Get him off the board. Yeah.
So, go ahead and call it.
Yes.
Time of death?
That is 2016. You gotta find it. Yeah.
You get an age on this kid?
Oh, yeah.
Tanya?
15.
Who?
Yeah, that was very difficult to film, and it really made me think about, you know, the caregivers in our public hospitals that have to deal with sort of gun violence and violent trauma on an often daily basis, weekly basis, day in, day out. At the same time that they're trying to, you know, manage people's primary care, it gave me a deepened respect for this group of caregivers, and because it's the experience of filming that, it still sticks with me, and it was really moving, disturbing, and just emotionally impactful. And so that's a piece that I don't think people quite understand about what caregivers are dealing with in terms of managing the entire health of this entire community. There's a wide spectrum of types of issues that they're dealing with.
And you also see soon after that the young resident struggling with, because he hasn't done it before, of having to then go out and tell the family what's happened.
Yeah, and you see that in residents. You know, these are residents, a lot of whom are coming from some of the best medical schools in the country, have maybe never, been this intimately connected to a community like this, who grow up very quickly as doctors in this hospital. And in that particular case, it was a young doctor who had never lost a patient before, and the attending physician is basically telling him how to tell the parents.
Yeah.
And he did it in a very clinical way, like, you know, don't beat around the bush. And you could see the sort of dazed look on that young resident's face.
Let's take one more caller. Megan in Oakland. Megan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I was an ER nurse for 20 years, and then I was a chiropractor for another 20. And during the time I was a chiropractor, I had an immigrant patient of mine that came in pregnant with these very bizarre symptoms. And she'd gone repeatedly to her OB, who told her it was a complication of pregnancy. And I called over to Highland because she was uninsured, and I managed to get through to an ER doc, and I sent her over there, and they personally saw her, did all the workup on her, and she ended up in intensive care that night with Guillain-Barré syndrome, and she was there for several weeks. They saved her life on a phone call.
Yeah. Megan, thank you. Thanks for telling us that story. Let's get in one more. Margaret joins us next. Margaret, go ahead, please.
Hello. I want to speak about this problem of dealing with people in the waiting room of an emergency room. I'm retired, so this is a long way back. But a woman came in after hearing that her husband had been hit. He was driving, and he had an auto accident, and he was in very bad condition. He wasn't expected to live, and she was about 8 months pregnant. And she got hysterical, and she wound up lying on the floor of the waiting room, screaming and kicking, and it was a terrible scene. Anyone waiting in that waiting room must have been horrified, and it was horrifying even to the nursing personnel. I got down on my knees next to her, and I tried to comfort her, and she wasn't being comforted. And I said, you've got to calm down somewhat. This isn't good for your baby. You've got to think about your baby. And, you know, she stopped the hysterics right away.
Margaret, thank you for the story. I'm afraid to, sorry to have to cut you a bit short, but we're almost out of time. But it's one more reminder, as we've heard through these calls throughout the hour, Peter, of it all happens there, all of it.
You know, it does. And one of the things that I felt was amazing in witnessing what happened in the waiting room wasn't just the scenes that unfolded, but the simple notion of people sitting down next to each other that normally would never come together. And meeting each other and learning a little bit about each other. Because sometimes when you're stuck for hours, you strike up conversations. These people get to know each other. You know, you have gangsters sitting next to nuns, sitting next to entrepreneurs, sitting next to artists. You know, it's really quite remarkable. And that learning, that listening is something that I feel we're lacking a bit right now in our public health, sort of the debate around our public health system.
Well, it brings back a bit more emphasis on the word care within healthcare system. You know, we always debate that as sort of those words all together as a group, healthcare system. But there's a lot of caring. There's a lot of care in the ER.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of challenge. And I think it's a mixed bag. And I think that what we're trying to remind people of is that, you know, we're all connected. We're all on this journey together. We're all vulnerable, you know, whether we have insurance or not, you know, our situation could change, you know, in an instant. But that we're all kind of bound together in a sense, and that it strikes me that we need to reframe the conversation a bit around and place it more, you know, bring humanity more into the conversation as opposed to being a politically divisive issue.
Peter Nix, the director of the new film The Waiting Room, opens today at the Sundance Kabuki in San Francisco, the Grand Lake in Oakland, and Camera 3 in San Jose. Again, you can see a trailer for the film on our website. Peter, congratulations. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, with help this week from Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Bradley Davis, Riva Gold, Norma McCartan, and Gina Shalaba. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.